Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. Preterm birth is a leading cause of neonatal death and increases the chances of disabilities and developmental delays in those infants who survive. My guest today is Dr. Lily Liu of the Children's Hospital at Providence. We're going to be discussing the infant who arrives too soon, talking about the care of the premature infant and how to prevent preterm birth. But before we get into today's program, I want to thank Dr. Thad Woodard, founding host of Line One, and for 20 years serving as the host or co-host of the program. But we're not letting him go far. He will continue to serve in an advisory role, and we anticipate that he'll be back at some point during the coming year to be a co-host emeritus. And I fully intend to have him as a guest on the show. And he's also with us in the studio today. Dr. Woodard, welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection.
I tell you, Jay, emeritus just doesn't quite sound right. I feel too young to be an emeritus, but I very much appreciate the willingness of you to take over this this job. And I got to correct you one thing. I was not the founding host. This program existed well before my roughly 20 years in this seat. But I've enjoyed it, and I think it's in good hands. So thanks for doing this yourself.
All right. Well, I appreciate that correction, and you've convinced me that it's going to be fun to whitewash this picket fence. So here I am in the host chair today. So, Dr. Liu, welcome to Line One.
Hi, Jay, and thanks, Thad, for your two decades of service as the voice of our medical community here in Alaska.
Thank you.
And Dr. Liu, I should add that you are either president or immediate past president of the Alaska chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Is that correct?
That is. I'm actually in my second term as president of the AAP Alaska chapter.
All right. Well, very good. Well, before we begin our discussion, I'd like to invite everyone to be able to join into the conversation and give us a call. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 550-8433. You can also call in toll-free statewide, and that number is 1-888-353-5752. And you can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. One word, line1@alaskapublic.org. And of course, if you're listening to the taped rebroadcast on Monday evening, we're eating dinner, so we can't take your call on the air, but you can continue the discussion by sending us comments or questions by email, and we will follow up. So, Dr. Liu, your specialty is neonatology. What is neonatology, and what's a day in the office for a neonatologist like?
Well, the word neonate means newborn. So a neonatologist is a doctor who takes care of babies who need some extra care right in the newborn period. Neonatologists are pediatricians who spend a few extra years specializing in the care of just newborn babies, not kids all the way up to age 18. We take care of babies in the newborn intensive care unit, usually, although we also take care of some well newborns as well. But one of the interesting definitions is the neonatal period, which is the first 28 days after birth. So most of the babies we take care of are very young, although some babies who need to stay in our unit, we can take care of for many months. When kids get older, we think that they start to need different kinds of support and a different kind of environment. So they'll sometimes move out of the newborn intensive care unit and up to a pediatric unit.
Okay. Well, it sounds like there's different levels of care. Tell us a little more about that. You run a neonatal intensive care unit at Providence. Are there other neonatal intensive care units in Anchorage? Is there a level of care that requires a transport down to Seattle?
Well, the only level 3 newborn intensive care unit, or NICU, is at Providence Alaska Medical Center in the Children's Hospital area. And the rating scale goes from low to high. So a level 4 NICU, like the one in Seattle or Portland, is one that can do cardio bypass surgery. And ECMO is the name for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or that very complicated level of care that we can't offer here in Alaska. But we are a level 3B unit, and that means we can take care of babies who are quite small and quite sick, who might need ventilator support and might need surgery and might need pediatric subspecialty care. There are several other NICUs in the state that are level 1 or level 2 NICUs, and some of them are also managed by neonatologists, but some are also are managed very well by pediatricians. And those are units where babies might need a little bit of breathing support and some tube feedings or some antibiotics, but they don't need sustained high-level intensive care.
Okay. So you mentioned extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. I'm going to guess that's outside of the heart and has something to do with delivering oxygen into the bloodstream. Is that correct?
It is. It's what you think of as bypass for if you had surgery on your heart. One of the problems with what we call ECMO, since it's hard to say all those words, is that it's non-pulsatile flow. So when your heart is beating, every time it beats, there's a push of blood through your blood vessels. But this is a machine that provides a constant flow, which physiologically, it's not quite the same.
Okay. So we were talking about preterm birth and term birth. What defines a preterm birth?
Well, babies are intended. They're designed to be born after 40 weeks of incubation in the uterus. And so any baby that's born close to that is full term. But if you're born at less than 37 weeks, you're considered to be preterm. If you're born at 34 to 37 weeks, we've actually learned in the recent handful of years that that's a very important category of babies because they're close to term. But if you take all of those babies who sometimes can go to the regular nursery, about a third of them will still have a problem. And those problems can be their blood sugar drops too low, or they don't eat very well, or they get cold, or they forget to breathe all the time and have to be stimulated. And that's just evidence that all their organ systems are still immature. And it's a reminder to us that it's good to be born at full term.
I have to admit, the most sleepless night I ever spent over a patient was a 34-week infant that was just absolutely robust and looked fabulous. And it was a good family. It was their second baby. And after long discussions, we agreed to discharge. And I worried about that baby, but talked with the mother in the morning, and it did fine at 34 weeks. On the other hand, many people may not remember that the last child born in the White House was a premature infant, Patrick Bouvier Kennedy, born in 1963. Was a 34 and a half weaker and only lived 2 days before dying of hyaline membrane disease, as they called it at the time.
Yes, hyaline membrane disease is a lung disease and one of the most critical organ systems that needs to be mature for babies to do well at birth are the lungs. And the name hyaline membrane disease is actually it actually comes from when you look under a microscope, what do the lungs look like? And the alveoli or air sacs are lined with this pink proteinaceous material called hyalin. And now we know that this is related to being born early and breathing oxygen instead of getting your nutrients and your oxygen supply through the placenta.
Okay. So are there limits to how preterm an infant can be and there still be a hope for survival?
When I was training a few decades ago, we used to think that it was really tough for 25-week babies to survive. But it's kind of interesting to look at the whole history over the last 40 years of neonatology, because first they defined low birth weight babies as those less than 2,500 grams, so 2.5 kilograms. And those babies were thought to be at really high risk of not making it. And then a decade or so later, they said, well, if you're 2,500 grams, you're low birth weight. But if you're 1,500 grams, your very low birth weight. And those babies were thought to have very little chance of not making it. And then they defined extremely low birth weight babies as those less than 1,000 grams. And I can tell you now that from 25 weeks to 24 weeks, we've had babies go home from our unit who were 22 weeks gestation. So we keep getting better, but we still don't know what the true limits of viability are. Babies who are born that early, they often have some challenges they need to face, and that comes from having to do a lot of their development outside the uterus.
Yes. Well, certainly I remember when I was in my training, and I trained in both adult and pediatric care, one night going from being on call in the adult emergency department and being involved in a resuscitation in the wee hours of the morning, going right into the NICU and going to the delivery room and being handed a very small endotracheal tube, and it went through my mind, how cute, it's so small. But of course, the patients were very small also. So oftentimes, early in life, help is needed to be able to oxygenate the blood, oftentimes using a ventilator. What are some of the other health concerns for caring for the premature infant?
Well, you just brought up respiratory disease again, and that hyaline membrane disease that we talked about earlier. Now we call it respiratory distress syndrome. And we've learned that before about 34 weeks, babies don't make a substance that we all make called surfactant. And that makes it really easy for us to take a breath because it reduces the surface tension. I kind of think of the first time you blow up a balloon, it's really hard because there's really high surface tension. And if you blow it up a bunch of times, it gets easier and easier. That's because you've lowered the surface tension. Well, one of the big developments, one of the what we call the penicillins of neonatology, is that we figured out how to make surfactant, how to purify it, and actually put it into the lungs of babies. And sometimes it's like magic. The moment that it gets down there, it's easier for them to take a breath, and their oxygen levels go up dramatically.
Oh, that's really interesting. How do you get it into the lungs?
Well, you talked about that endotracheal tube, and it's something that you have to put directly into the lungs. So we use a special instrument called a laryngoscope, and we look down at the vocal cord so that we can carefully put the tube down into the trachea, and we instill it directly into the lungs, and it instantaneously disperses throughout and makes it easier for the baby to expand their lungs.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate the balloon analogy. That really, I think, helps all of us understand what we're talking about in terms of the role of surfactant and some of the challenges in terms of how do you breathe for the premature infant. So this is Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. You're welcome to join the conversation. My guest today is Dr. Lily Liu of the Providence Children's Hospital, and we're discussing the premature infant and prevention of premature births. If you're in the Anchorage area, the local number is 550-8433, and you can also call in toll-free statewide. That number is 1-888-353-5752. And you can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Dr. Liu, we've talked about lungs. What are some of the other concerns when a very premature infant is born?
Well, every organ system is immature, and we've learned so much in the past few decades. One of the things that, again, harking back to the Kennedy baby, to Patrick, we learned that babies who had lung problems, had breathing problems because of prematurity, they did better with oxygen. So we put a lot of babies into 100% oxygen, and we thought, this is great. There are dramatically more babies surviving. But then we started finding that many of them became blind. And part of that is because the eyes are not mature, and they're used to a low oxygen environment. And when they're born and exposed to the oxygen in the atmosphere instead of the lower amount in the uterus, or when they're even more risky, exposed to the oxygen in a ventilator circuit, then the retinas developed abnormally, and they would get so scarred that in the beginning, many of them actually detached. So they called that disease retrolental fibroplasia because they thought there was just some fibrous material growing behind the eyes. When we figured out that oxygen was great for lungs, but maybe was a little damaging to the eyes, we started using it more carefully. We didn't put babies in 100% oxygen. We tempered it down. We gave what they needed, but no more. And we saw that we were able to hold on to those advances in survival and have much less eye disease.
Okay. As I recall, there's some issues with the vascular tissue growing. I think at one time there was research into a anti-vascular growth factor to be used in treatment. Is that something that kind of came and went or never really made it to clinical practice? Or how do you prevent that kind of retinopathy of prematurity today?
We do use that medication. The name for it is Avastin. Okay. And what that does is it slows down the growth of the blood vessels on the retina, which cause that scarring. But one of the most important things we do is we try to pay attention to the oxygen levels very closely with a machine that we call an oximeter. So we try to we track the oxygen levels, and we don't let it be 100% because then we know we can turn it down a little bit. The other thing is that we do screening exams. So the eye doctor comes in and looks at the babies who are considered to be at risk, and the exams are done every week so that if they pick up eye disease that's leading towards a risk of blindness, they can either use something like that Avastin, which they instill into the eye material, and that slows down the scarring, or they can actually tack down the retina. If you think of a room with wallpaper, the retina is like the wallpaper. And if you think of a room that's shaped like a ball, if you have scarring, you know, if you have a scar on your skin, as it heals, it shrinks down. So if you have a scar on the wallpaper inside a round room, you can imagine that it would pull that retina off if it progresses too far. So another treatment is done with a laser, and it just tacks down that wallpaper to the wall and prevents it from detaching, which is what causes the blindness.
Okay. So we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Line One, your health connection with, I'm your host, Dr. Jay Butler, and with me today is Dr. Lily Liu of the Children's Hospital at Providence, and we're discussing the premature infant.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media in Anchorage. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler, and my guest is Dr. Lily Liu of the Children's Hospital at Providence. Our topic is care of the premature infant and prevention of premature birth. If you have questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you, or if you have some experience to share, either as a parent of a premature infant or if you were actually born as a premature infant, we'd love to hear from you. Here in Anchorage, the local number is 550-8433. You can also call in toll-free statewide. That number is 1-888-353-5752. And we can also take your emails. That address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And of course, if you're listening tonight on the taped rebroadcast, we can't take your questions, but we'd love to hear from you by email. So, Dr. Liu, we were talking about barely 50 years ago, the Kennedy baby died. I think by the time we were doing our training, probably not much more than 20 years after that, very premature infants, 24, even sometimes 23 weeks, were coming into the NICU. Survival of those very young babies was fairly low, is really, as I recall, less than 50% overall. How are we doing today? Have we made progress? And so tell us more.
We have made progress, but as you get younger and younger, the progress slows. And so what we talked about earlier with that 2,500 grams to 1,500 grams to 1,000 grams, we actually do have babies go home who are less than 500 grams. That's less than this cup that I'm holding in my hand. So it's really miraculous that those babies can actually do some of their development. We've mostly been talking about lung development and eye development, but some of the other challenges that they face are your brain is also immature, your bowel is immature, and your immune system is immature. So we also have issues like intraventricular hemorrhage and periventricular leukomalacia. So IVH and PVL are really long words, but they just mean that the brain is at risk for injury if you're born early. It's a pretty traumatic process to go through birth. And so there's this really rich area of, it's a really rich capillary bed where brain cells are being born. So you can imagine that that's at risk for being squished and having a hemorrhage in the birth process when it happens early. And so those are major morbidities. So when babies have blindness or lung disease where they have to go home on oxygen, or they have an intraventricular hemorrhage, those are major morbidities. One of the trends that we're seeing with the survivors now is that we realize that what we called minor morbidities are really important. If you think about what it's like to have a preemie baby, we think that every parent of a premature baby is a superstar. But when you're not only dealing with trying to avoid the major morbidities, but sometimes some learning challenges, there is a higher rate of autism spectrum diagnosis in premature babies. Some babies who spent their first few months in an intensive care setting where every time they get touched, somebody was poking their heel to draw their blood or their ventilator was being adjusted. Some of those babies are very sensitive to sounds or to touch. And if you can imagine being a parent, we are understanding now that those are significant challenges, not just what we used to call the major problems. So we are learning that it's really important to prepare parents for what to expect and provide them with all the tools they have to be successful.
Well, you mentioned families. Of course, there's an old joke in obstetrics that it's a great practice because on average, when you complete a procedure, you have twice as many patients as when you started. But we've talked a lot about the infant, but of course, you're caring for an entire family. And oftentimes, these are families that are going through quite a bit with a very ill child. How do you engage with the family?
Families are crucial in the care that we provide. Our unit at Providence has 66 single-room beds, and we invite parents. We actually don't call them visitors. We consider that they're partners in our care. We think that they're very helpful in being a second pair of hands when care is being provided. And the unit at the Children's Hospital just finished an annual event, or they're just finishing up an annual event called the Kangaroo-a-thon. And one of the fun things that we do each year is this Kangaroo-a-thon. And kangaroo care was actually developed in resource-poor countries that didn't have a lot of incubators, and it was a way to keep babies warm by putting them skin-to-skin with their parents. And we have lots of technology here, but we've learned how important that is for a couple of reasons. One is it's invaluable bonding for a baby to be with their parent in a positive touch encounter. So we ask that parents are skin-to-skin in a comfortable, safe position. So we have recliners in every room. They're actually quite comfortable. And we like the sessions to be at least 90 minutes long so that it's not disruptive to their sleep pattern, but they can get settled and stay in being held skin-to-skin for an extended period of time. But we are all learning more about the microbiome, and we're talking about mostly healthy parents, and we all have bacteria on our skin that are actually our first line of defense against pathogenic bacteria or bacteria that cause disease. So what we want is for our new babies to be colonized with the healthy bacteria that their parents have on their skin, and kangaroo care is biologically effective in that way.
Okay. Well, of course, a lot of the bacteria that are in us are in the GI tract, which raises questions about the exposure that an infant would have during delivery, whether that's by a vaginal birth or a cesarean section, and also that are acquired by mouth, thinking about nutrition. So these very, very young babies, are there opportunities for them to be able to be feeding and growing on their mother's milk?
We've learned very emphatically that human milk is the best diet for human babies. There was great excitement a generation ago about how we could make baby formula, and that would let moms go back to work, and you know, this was just as good nutritionally. And what we've learned, mostly especially in the premature babies, is that it's actually critically important to try to have the proteins that babies with developing guts to only expose them to what they were designed to eat. So we use human milk as much as we can.
Okay. And we have a caller, Jana from Anchorage. Welcome to Line 1, your health connection.
Hello.
Hi.
I was born December 24th, 1954, but I wasn't due until February 11th, 1955. I don't know how many days premature that is, but it was a lot. I was 3 pounds, 4 ounces. I was the fourth child. My mother had already had three. She wasn't a doctor or a scientist, but she knew bad things happened to babies in incubators. So the doctor said, well, then take her home. And I came home. And had no intellectual or physical repercussions from being that premature. So when I have friends who have children or grandchildren who are premature, I always tell them, maybe you don't need to worry. Maybe things will work out just fine. Because there were no such thing as a NICU when I was born. So they took me home basically in a shoebox.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Jana, for that call and for sharing that story. Now, Dr. Liu, you mentioned the microbiome earlier. I'm wondering if Jana's story might again suggest that exposure to some bacteria is beneficial, other bacteria, of course, not so beneficial.
Well, I think that exposure to normal bacteria and colonization with what we call normal flora is really important. And one of the things that can happen in a hospital is that you might get treated with antibiotics. And Jana, really happy to hear your story, and maybe not getting treated made sure that you developed normal flora. So one of the things that's amazing about the placenta is there's this great gift that mothers give to their babies, and they send so many nutrients and other kinds of proteins across the placenta, mostly in the last trimester and really mostly in the last month. And some of those proteins are antibodies that protect against disease. So I think of babies who are born early as missing that gift, and I call them immunovulnerable. So so they are susceptible to infections with certain kinds of bacteria, and maybe maintaining their normal flora as much as possible is one of the most important things we can do to help fight that.
All right. So this is Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. This is Dr. Jay Butler. My guest today is Dr. Lily Liu of the Children's Hospital at Providence, and we're talking about preterm infancy, preterm delivery and care of the preterm infant, and prevention of preterm birth. If you're in the Anchorage area, you're welcome to join the conversation at 550-8433. You can also call in toll-free statewide, 1-888-353-5752. And you can also send us an email at line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Dr. Liu, you mentioned antibodies that are shared across the placenta from the mother to the infant, and that that doesn't happen until a little later in pregnancy. It raises some of the questions about care for infants that are born later in pregnancy or even born at term in terms of the protections that they get from their mother. I know in a lot of developing countries where access to care is fairly limited, there has been a lot of interest in immunization of the mother so that those antibodies would cross the placenta. And I see more and more of that in our country also with influenza immunization being, and also whooping cough, pertussis immunization during pregnancy to be able to get those antibodies into the infant. Is that something that is making a difference? Is that a good idea?
I think that immunizations are one of the most significant developments in modern healthcare. And now I'm talking from my AAP hat as a pediatrician. And I think that it's unfortunate that some information, some beliefs about immunizations have gotten out there based on some papers that were actually proven to be fraudulent. But we've recently had a big battle with mumps in Alaska. And there are a lot of really smart researchers who recommend an immunization schedule, but because they're constantly studying this, there's always updates to what we know. So if you're pregnant and thinking about immunizations, it's probably a good idea to check with your doctor about which ones should be given during pregnancy and which ones can be given as soon as you deliver, and how the flu season's going and whether or not you need an extra mumps vaccination because of an ongoing epidemic.
Okay. Well, we've had one caller share her experience having been born roughly 8 weeks early, and she is now well into her 60s. When we were training, we were, of course, taking care of patients down to about 24 weeks, some of them only 500 grams, barely a pound. They're 30 years old now, some of them in their mid-30s. How are they doing?
You know, there's some really important work that was done by Dr. Saroj Saigal in Canada. She's done a remarkable job of following her prematurely born infants into their 30s and 40s and maybe even 50s by now. And she got a very strong message from them that even though in those days they did deal with a lot of those major morbidities, sometimes with blindness or cerebral palsy or those kinds of things, but they were almost universally happy to be alive and grateful that efforts were made to save their lives. She found that many of them were less risk, that had less risk-taking behavior than their age peers who were born at full term. But in generally, it's a very heartwarming story that these people who survived in the pioneering days of neonatology were really happy to be here. Oh. So some of her stories are told in her book that comes with a video, so you can actually see these interviews called Preemie Voices.
Yeah. In fact, we hopefully will have on our website a link to the Preemie Voices video, and I really recommend that and not just anyone who's interested in the topic get a look at that, but if you're a healthcare provider, I think it's very eye-opening to see how well many of the patients that we were taking care of 30 years ago have turned out. They're oftentimes professionals and really are very successful and productive adults. And as you say, they're very grateful for the care that they received and the relationship with their families that developed starting even in the neonatal intensive care unit that I think is highlighted in the film. So let's talk about we've spent a lot of time talking about the premature infant, but also sometimes babies that are born at term can be very sick. Let's talk a little more about what are some of the concerns that that you have, and what kind of care is available in the intensive care unit for neonates at Providence.
Well, about 70% of the babies who are in a NICU are there because they were born early. And about 70%, not necessarily the same, but you can imagine there's a lot of overlap, are there because they need help with breathing support. But sometimes full-term babies come because they're born with birth defects that need surgery, or some babies have infections that need to be treated. Some babies have problems with blood sugar, and those might be babies who were born to moms who had diabetes during pregnancy. And one of the trends that we're seeing across the country is we are taking care of a lot of babies who are exposed to substances during the pregnancy, and that they need to go through a process of withdrawal from those. So we used to call withdrawal from opioids neonatal abstinence syndrome, and now if you just look at those words, they kind of don't mean anything. So now we're shifting our terminology to neonatal opioid withdrawal syndrome.
Okay. So we're going to take a short break again for about a minute, and we'll be right back with Dr. Lily Liu of the Children's Hospital at Providence. Our discussion is on care of the premature infant. And we'll be right back. This is Line 1 on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler, and my guest is Dr. Lily Liu of the Children's Hospital at Providence. And we're talking about premature infants, care of the sick newborn, and prevention of premature births. So if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 550-8433. You can also call in statewide by dialing 888-353-5752. Although I guess nobody dials anymore, you'd be pushing the buttons. Or if you do dial, put your Betamax on pause also. And since we are in the 21st century, we also will be happy to take your email, line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Dr. Liu, we had a call a little earlier from someone who did very well, being born roughly 2 months premature. Not everyone does as well. While survival is good and most outcomes are excellent, there are some of the subtle manifestations that you mentioned earlier. What are some of those? We talked about limitations, retinopathy of prematurity leading to some problems with vision. What are some of the other issues that that a older child or an adult who was born premature may be dealing with?
Well, going back to one of the major problems, when you're born early and you don't get all your nutrition through the placenta, you can also develop a bowel problem that can be very serious. And we had started talking a little bit earlier about how we've learned that for human babies, human milk is the best diet. So we are learning different ways to prevent this problem called necrotizing enterocolitis. And one of the ways that we do it is that we try to use as much human milk as possible. But premature babies who miss that last big bunch of nutrition that you would get across the placenta, they usually need something extra. And so we have additives for milk, and we're even learning how to make those additives from human milk that's provided by donors to human milk banks. So another way that we're thinking about preventing necrotizing enterocolitis or NEC is a hot topic in NICUs these days, and that's the use of probiotics. And we all think about probiotics as something you can get at the health food store, and that tries to maintain the normal flora that we may lose from treatment with antibiotics and being in a hospital and things like that. But again, babies are very susceptible to infection, and when you give live organisms, you can actually get an infection with those organisms. So there's use of probiotics in many other countries around the world, but the U.S. has very high standards for what they call good manufacturing practices. And so we're still waiting for a probiotic preparation to be available that's safe for neonates.
And of course, you're actually bringing up a great topic for a future show, and that is the microbiome. I think we've learned a lot about the role of bacteria that are within us and on us. I've always been fascinated by the fact that there's probably 10 times as many bacteria in us and on us as there are cells that contain our own DNA. I've heard it calculated that we have about 3 pounds of bacteria within us. So that's about the same weight as an adult brain. So
right.
Some of the emerging data on the role of our bacteria and our health is very compelling. There's certainly a lot of marketing of probiotics right now. So that'll be a topic that I think we'll want to return to in the future. So we've talked a little bit about the development of the brain. I think about some of the early life events and that can impact the brain. What about cerebral palsy? That's a diagnosis we don't hear as much, it seems like, anymore. Are premature infants at higher risk of cerebral palsy? And as far as that goes, what is cerebral palsy?
Cerebral palsy, you usually think about as impairments of motor function. So these are babies who don't have the control over their limbs so that they can walk like babies without cerebral palsy. We were talking during the break about how we don't see that as much anymore. That's really true. But premature babies are at higher risk for cerebral palsy. But cerebral palsy can happen in full-term babies who don't have any history of prematurity at all. One of the things that we do is we try to minimize the intraventricular hemorrhage, and there are a few things that impact that. Babies who are born by C-section, if they present in certain positions when they're premature, do a little bit better in terms of that IVH incidence. But we're also learning that there are things we can do in the NICU to minimize brain injury. One is that we used to nurse babies flat on a flat surface with their arms extended. Sometimes we even had little soft restraints around them so that they wouldn't pull out their IVs and things like that. Well, we've learned that developmentally appropriate positioning is really important. So now you'll see babies in NICUs flexed in little nests made of blankets so that they're in an appropriate position to develop in. We've learned that when you have to be on a ventilator, sometimes the ventilator is off to the side, but we've learned that it's really important to keep the head midline, because if you crank your neck all the way over, that might change the way that blood flows to your brain. So we've learned little things like that. We've learned the importance of positive touch and parent skin contact. And we've learned a lot about the sound environment and the light environment that can impact babies' brain development.
Okay. You mentioned delivery by cesarean section maybe being a better way to deliver a baby in a certain if they're in a certain position in terms of thinking about potential for trauma to the brain. Maybe clarify that a little bit. I was a little confused there.
Oh, if you're a premature baby and you're breech, those babies, if they're born by, you know, a surgical extraction instead of going through the vagina in the breech position, might do a little bit better in terms of their risk of having an IVH. That has to be weighed by the risks of having a C-section delivery and how that might impact future pregnancies. So our specialty, we actually work really closely with our obstetrical colleagues, and that's a decision that we defer to the OB to make the decision about the route of delivery. But everything from the route of delivery to the amount of light that you're exposed to the amount of sound or the amount of time that you hear a human voice can impact your brain development. They've found that actually the difference between a recorded voice is not the same as an interactive voice, and a male or female voice may be different. So everything in the environment impacts how your brain develops.
Okay. Well, we have a caller, Rich in Wasilla. Welcome to Line 1, your health connection.
Hi, Rich.
Yes. Hi. I'm interested in, years ago, 38 weeks was considered term, and you just mentioned 38 to 40. I'm interested in the complications that occur when a baby is past 40 and where those limits go before C-section and that whole discussion of 40 to whatever number it is.
That's a great question. It also gives me a chance to say that, some of my friends who are developmental pediatricians, they say they can tell the difference between a 40-weeker and a 39-weeker. So things are happening so fast in the development of a baby. But the placenta is not designed to last forever. And so when you start getting to term, it starts to not be as effective in doing its job. And so babies who go past 40 weeks or 41 weeks, we really start worrying that they may get stressed in utero, and that can cause some problems. Some of you may have heard of meconium. When babies get stressed, they sometimes pass fetal stool into the amniotic fluid, and you can imagine that's not good for your lungs to breathe in. But what's more important is that that's a sign of stress for the baby. And as you use up the life of the placenta, then you start getting into problems like that. So more is not better. When you get past 40 weeks, we also start worrying about some complications of pregnancy.
So like 41 weeks and past, it's time to really seriously consider a C-section is kind of what I'm hearing.
It may be a consideration to try to prompt delivery, and that can be done surgically with a C-section, but there are also ways the obstetricians have of inducing delivery.
Oh, yeah, well, that happens. And what about the people who are doing a lot of home births? And what about this thing about the placenta not being severed at a certain point of time? What's going on with that?
I think you're talking about the lotus birth phenomenon where the placenta is just left attached. And, you know, we wonder because that's all really rich tissue that can be a source for bacterial growth. So one of the things we worry about is whether that's increases your risk of infection if you don't at some reasonable time sever the cord.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Great questions.
Thank you for calling, Rich. So you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. You're welcome to join the conversation here in the Anchorage area. The number is 550-8433. Also toll-free statewide, 888-353-5752, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Liu, we were talking about management of the placenta, and that's another one of those questions where it seems like there has been evidence that practice should be one thing and then something else. And there was a time when you wanted to milk the placenta to get as much of the blood into the infant as possible. Then there were concerns about having too high a red blood cell count and it being a risk factor for neonatal jaundice. What, you know, from your perspective, taking care of the infant once they're out and no longer connected to the placenta, what is the person delivering the baby to do?
So, well, I think you're talking about a practice called delayed cord clamping, and I actually like to call it timed cord clamping. And one of the interesting things when you look at the research on this topic is that there's not really any evidence that the cord has to be clamped immediately. We just started, as we, you know, started having more births in hospitals, we just tried to make the process clean and cut the cord right away and took the baby away to a resuscitation area. But what happens when you do that is that you take away the ability for the placenta to pump a little bit of extra blood into the baby. And for most babies, it doesn't make that much difference. But especially for the preemies, it can actually prevent, if you delay the cord clamping and you let the placenta transfuse the baby, then you may not have to give a blood transfusion later. So I think the neonatology community is coming around to the idea that that's the right thing to do. They've also found that it decreases the incidences of one of those major morbidities, the risk of intraventricular hemorrhage or brain bleed is less if you delay cord clamping. So it seems like there's a great benefit to premature babies.
Hmm. So whether you're a newborn or a young adult, there's a point where you have to cut the cord.
It has to be just right.
Okay. So you mentioned earlier neonatal opioid withdrawal syndrome. Is that something that you're seeing more of?
We're seeing more of that across the country. And I suspect that we're not seeing all of it because some of those babies don't come to care. But babies who are exposed to drugs before they're born, they see the effects of those drugs if they cross the placenta. And we are undoubtedly seeing an increase in opioid use in our country. You know, a while ago, we thought no one should ever experience pain, so we called pain the fifth vital sign, and we filled our coffers with opioids, and it wasn't until later that we realized that this was causing problems for people with addiction and for exposure to babies. And when that happens, just like with an adult, if you stop cold turkey, you're going to go through some serious symptoms. So we actually treat neonatal opioid withdrawal syndrome with medications that work on the same receptors that we can decrease the dose gradually and have kind of a controlled withdrawal. One thing that's really important, though, is that babies who are exposed to drugs in utero, they might have symptoms of withdrawing when you take it away. They may also just have some fixed sequela or some side effects or effects from being exposed to drugs, and their brains may develop differently, but that's not going to get better from gradually withdrawing the narcotics.
Okay. So when we think about exposures in utero that might have either impact on the newborn period or even long-term effects, I think there's not a lot of debate about risks from alcohol or from tobacco. But of course, we're one of the 9 states now where marijuana is legal. Is marijuana safe to use during pregnancy?
That's a good question. And I've even heard that it's being recommended that moms use marijuana for the nausea that they might get in pregnancy. And that concerns me because marijuana is one of those substances that's stored in fat cells. And especially later in pregnancy, the baby's laying down lots of, you know, healthy fat and everything. So you can imagine that the exposure to something that's not naturally in the mother's body could cause problems in the organs that are developing so quickly. And when you think of breast milk, which we just talked about how important it is for human babies to get human milk, we know that a lot of the content of breast milk is fat. So there's some research that shows that marijuana exposure to the developing brain may affect things like what we call executive function or decision-making and judgment, and may affect babies who have a propensity towards psychosis to lower the threshold for those kinds of incidents. But truly, we need to do more research on this.
Okay. So it sounds like there's a lot we just don't know about marijuana and use during pregnancy at this time.
Right. And you can't find a stronger champion for breastfeeding than a neonatologist. And so marijuana may not be, you know, best to expose your baby to, but we don't really recommend against breastfeeding if you're using marijuana. But we do think it's important to keep up with the research and let our families know what our concerns are so that they can make the best decision for their children.
Okay. So, Dr. Liu, we have about a minute left. I'm going to use Dr. Woodard's favorite question and ask you, so what would you hope all of the listeners will take home from the discussion today?
Well, first of all, it's such a privilege to be a neonatologist, to be involved with families when something as important as a birth of a baby is happening. But I think for most of our discussion, we've talked about how important it is to be born full term and getting good prenatal care and avoiding smoking and alcohol and substances like that and picking up on any problems that a baby is having early can make a bigger difference in a baby than it could for the same kind of injury or deficit in an older patient. So good attention and intervention is key.
Okay. Well, we're out of time. Dr. Liu of the Children's Hospital at Providence, thank you for joining us today on Line One, Your Health Connection. And thanks to all of you for listening today. Next week, Prentice Pemberton will be back. Dave Waldron produced today's program and was also the sound engineer. Eric Bork is our web editor. This is Dr. Jay Butler wishing you a healthy life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.